Hey, folks, it's Dave Ramsey. This is a really special episode of the Entree Leadership Podcast today. At the end of the episode, I'm going to be making a big announcement, so be sure and stay with us. But as you know, Chris Hogan's usually on this microphone, and I asked if I could step in and bump him out, and since I own the place, they let me. And the reason I did is our guest today. One of my favorite people on the planet is Seth Godin. He and I was a huge admirer from afar for years, and I contacted him, and we got to have lunch a few years ago in New York. And Seth has written 14 books that have been translated into more than 30 languages. He has the most successful marketing blog in the world. That's not an exaggeration. He's the founder of Squidoo, which is a fast-growing recommendation website. He has an MBA from Stanford, and he's been called the ultimate entrepreneur for the information age by Business Week. American Way magazine says he's America's greatest marketer, and that's the phrase I would put on him. I just said, if you're doing marketing of any kind, you're not reading Seth Godin, then you're not yet doing marketing because you don't know what's going on. He has the best brain for marketing, as far as I'm concerned, on the planet. And I'll tell you something else a lot of you may or may not know about Seth, that you know and follow his work. He's one of the most generous people that I know. I've yet to email him and ask him a question, but when I don't get a response within 30 or 45 seconds, maybe 30 or 45 minutes, but always willing to help with the project, always willing to make a suggestion, and always willing to let us pick his unbelievable brain in marketing. Seth, it's an honor to have you with us at Entree Leadership today.
Well, I got to tell you, with an intro like that, I think I should just quit while I'm ahead and we can go on to the next thing.
We'll just ship that to your mom by MP3, okay? Man, welcome. So what is going on in Seth Godin's world today? What are you working on?
Well, let's see. I just passed my 5,000th blog post. So I've been doing that for every day for more than 10 years, and that's been a real testament to the power of dripping. That, you know, we are all so focused on the grand opening or the sign that says under new management. We're also focused on how do I make this list or that list or this number when I launch something. But what I have found is that the discipline of showing up every single day with the most relevant and interesting and generous thing I can think of, it adds up. And there isn't one post I've done that changed everything for me or anyone. But I like to think that over time, that practice, chopping wood and carrying water and showing up, has changed me, and it's changed a lot of the people who subscribe. So that is sort of the constant in my life.
I think the discipline that your brain has to engage in and your body to do something that has that kind of rhythm to it on a daily basis causes you to over time to be able to win death by a thousand cuts. I try to teach business people all the time, quit swinging for the fence, hit singles, win death by a thousand cuts, and that's really what you've done, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and you know what's fascinating is if you need to have a conversation with yourself that says, should I go on a sales call today, should I write a blog post today, should I do whatever, it's really easy for that conversation to take up a lot of time and for the answer to be, nah, I'll just do it tomorrow. But if you don't have to have that conversation, if you know you're going to go on a sales call every day, if you know you're going to send a nice note to one of your employees every day, if you know you're going to write a blog post every day, then a different part of your brain kicks in. And it's saying, oh boy, I owe something. I have an hour left. What am I going to do? And something will happen, because your brain won't let you fail.
Mm. It's the old Earl Nightingale thing from The Strangest Secret. We only tap about 20% of our potential. But when you put yourself into a disciplined move, you really it does open up everything else. So out of all of your books, I have my favorites. Which one do you think is your favorite today?
Well, you see, I'm not going to ask you which is your favorite kid. But for me, the book, and I'm not working on any new books. I had four come out on January 1st, and I've said this before, but this time I probably mean it, that there's nothing that demands a book from me right now. For me, a book is a tool, and I don't write a book to write a book. I write a book to make change happen. And so when I think about how the dip has changed people's lives, or when I think about the feedback I've gotten from Tribes or from, you know, later books like We Are All Weird or Icarus. Those books stand out for me because they weren't necessarily the hardest books for me to write. I wrote The Dip in about 2 weeks, but they were the books that people found something in that allowed them to accomplish the change they were seeking. And I'm in the change business. I don't sell stuff. I help people make the change that they want. And if I can put something in the world like a book that does that, it's thrilling, because unlike a web video or something, a book's going to be around for a long time, and I don't have to write it every day for it to keep working.
They do just keep beating the drum for you, because those pages are still sitting there ready to be turned. That's an important point. And I go all the way back to the permission marketing, Purple Cow days, and then Meatball Sunday, and then I like the new ones. Tribes still might be. Maybe it was the teacher. Maybe when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Maybe that's what it was for me with Tribes. But I am convinced Tribes might be the manifesto for marketing for the next two decades, that people who don't understand tribal marketing really aren't in marketing anymore.
Well, so let's put some meat on those bones for the listeners who haven't had a chance to read it yet. You know, you are a living, breathing example of what I'm talking about. So there are a few million people who are listening to us, and that's less than 1% of the people in the United States. But this group has an enormous amount in common, not just demographically, because that's not really that interesting, but psychographically. They share a worldview. They share a pulse. They share a set of goals. They share assumptions about the people they meet and the opportunities they see. So the typical person walking down the street says, "How do I work less?" And the typical person listening to this says, "How do I make more? How do I create more impact?" That emotional connection enables the tribe, this group, to be able to make a real impact because they're doing something similar. And then someone like you shows up, someone brave enough to stand up and say, "Follow me." And what you do for a living is you keep the tribe in sync. And the tribe needs to be in sync. We need that deep down from an evolutionary point of view. We need to do what other people like us are doing. And so in your role as the leader of this tribe, you cannot command people to do something. You cannot insist that they do something. But because you have permission to talk to them, you can whisper to them. And as they get more and more in sync, it means that you have more impact and thus revenue follows. But you're not doing it for the revenue, like most of us don't do it for the revenue. You're doing it because the output of a tribe synchronized is so powerful. And so if you're really going to run a small business for the future, you're not going to run a small business for the future because you are the only store in town that sells something, because that's never going to be true again. We have the internet. You're going to succeed because you are the ringleader, the drum major, the person who keeps your tribe, whichever tribe that is, in sync, because that's what they want.
I was with a group of advertisers the other day in one of our cities that carries our radio show, and they were local advertisers on that particular. And one of the guys spoke up who's in I won't say the industry, but he's in a generic industry. And I was talking about Tribes, and he said, "Yeah, Dave, but you're a trust brand." And I looked at him and I said, "Dude, if you're in business and you're not a trust brand, you're going to be out of business soon."
Exactly.
Everybody is in the trust business, aren't they?
Exactly, because if you have no choice, then you will buy from someone you don't trust. But if you have a choice, you're either only going to pick the cheapest one, which is a problem because if you race to the bottom, you might win, or you're going to pick the trusted one. Why else would you pick anything but that? And so if someone says, "I'm a plumber, but I'm not a trusted plumber," well, then game's over.
You're getting ready to be an employee of someone who is a trusted plumber.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're about to go out of business and sell your business for pennies on the dollar. That's what it comes down to. One of your famous things, I think you say, and I love it, is the customer pays three ways: money, trust, and referrals. Break that down.
Okay, so money is the one that everyone's obsessed with, right?
Yeah, money is how the customer pays, but yeah, they also pay.
But the other two are trust and referral. So when I trust you, I am giving you something that is emotionally difficult. I am out on a limb. If you violate my trust, I will carry that around far longer than I will carry around the money I lost from you. That feeling of being violated because my trust was abused, I mean, getting people to give you their trust is way more difficult than getting them to give you their money. And then the magic, though, is if you give people, if people give you their trust and you treat it with respect, they will respond by giving you a referral. I got an email 10 minutes ago from a student at Purdue University. She sent her resume and said, "Will you hire me?" And I wrote back saying, "I don't have any employees. I'm a soloist." And then she wrote back saying, "Well, would you mind forwarding my resume to everyone you know who might have a job for me?" And the insanity of that is, I don't trust her. I don't know her. Why would I expend the trust I have with my network and forward her resume to them when I can't honor their trust and thus make the referral by saying, I trust this woman? I don't. And so when we're running around selling life insurance and everything else, twisting people's arms, asking for referrals, it's ridiculous because we've lost our way because we haven't earned the trust first.
And trust is really, that leads to referral. It has a deep relationship component. And so businesses that are not relationship driven, that become transactional and not relational, really kind of doomed to fail in the coming economy, aren't they?
Yeah, so, you know, a guy came, our air conditioner broke when we moved into our new house. That's what always happens.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy came to quote me on the installation. He said, "Well, while I'm looking in the basement, would you just look this over?" And he handed me a 4-page, single-spaced sheet of paper listing with names and addresses and phone numbers people who lived within 5 miles of my house who had given him the right to put their referral on the sheet of paper. 4 pages of people with names and phone numbers. And he got upstairs and I said, "You're hired." I mean, what else was there to ask about?
Yeah, right? That is game over.
So over the top, it had taken him a decade to earn that piece of paper. And so someone listening to this says, "Well, I can't possibly get something like that." And I would say, well, then you need to do a business a different way.
Yeah, it's going to take time, and you're going to do it in the rhythm of life, and you're going to win death by 1,000 cuts. Trust is not extended overnight. And people who do extend trust instantaneously based on plastic credentials or something are the ones that are usually disappointed in folks.
Yep.
Being marketing-driven versus being market-driven, walk through that a little bit, because I think that's fascinating.
Well, I heard this from a professor I had in college 412 years ago, and I asked him, he was working at a software company at the time, and I said, "So, you know, does the marketing department have a lot of say about the way you make products? Does the marketing department have a lot of influence on your policies?" And he said, "Well, that kind of company is marketing-driven. And what that means is that the marketing person has power and influence and authority." He said, "We are market-driven, meaning we're going to bypass the marketing department and focus instead on where the market is going and where we think the market is." You can also be sales-driven, in which the salesperson, and lots of people listening here are salespeople, and that's how you've built your company, where the sales department drives things. And so a sales-driven company has the sales department always focused on what their buyer wants, as opposed to a company that's more market-driven. And that distinction is really critical. If I look at the difference between, it's the year 2002, 11 years ago, between Dell and Apple, Dell Computer was driven by production and sales. So the sales department dictated everything that would make the phone ring and sales get made, and the production department dictated how they could make everything cheaper. And at Apple Computer, neither of those things drove any of the decisions that they made. And that's why the two companies reversed positions over the last 12 years, because one company was driven by only one thing: how do we lead this market? And the other company was driven by how do we make the sales department happy and how do we cut our costs.
We tell entree leaders all the time, which is, it's a natural thing for those of us that have an entrepreneurial flair. I mean, one of the definitions, the base definitions of entrepreneurs, find a need and fill it, find a need and fill it, rather than make something and build it and they will come. You know, instead, let's find a need and figure out a way to serve someone. So we teach people all the time. I was with a major Fortune 500 corporation, their director of sales, not long ago. We spent some time together, and they're shifting their whole sales team's model. And he was talking to me about it because it's what we've done. We're certainly not that big, but he and I are just connected. And so, and they're just changing their words. I told him, I said, quit calling your people sellers. Just call them servers. Get people who know how to serve. Because if you have a product that is needed, that the market already, that is market driven, you're not selling, you're serving, you're just helping people. And it changes everyone's mentality.
It does. Let me try to add a little bit of nuance there, because it's very easy for someone to hear that and decide to be in the RFP business, to decide to wait until someone says, I need a new air conditioner, or someone says, I need a bid to give me 4,000 tasers for my security force. If you do that, then what you've decided is that what the market is needing is a product, and that the only way you're going to know about it is when the market raises its hand. And the problem then is that the market has already decided what it wants and is now looking for the lowest price. And that the way you cut through that is by understanding that what the market actually needs is a sense of trust or safety or belonging or achievement. That when we buy things, unless we're buying brown rice and black beans and clean water, we tend to be buying things for the way it makes us feel, not because we need it as a matter of life or death. And so when I buy an airplane ticket or a book or a hotel room, I am probably not buying the absolute cheapest one. I am buying something that gives me a feeling. And people are always going to need these feelings, but we call that want. And great companies and great marketers don't look for a market where there's all these people who are already buying a commodity. They look for an unmet need that is based on a human emotion. And that instinct of seeing a little bit ahead is how you invent Chipotle, instead of saying, well, we're just going to be like every other taco shop. Right? But that leap forward is the exciting part for me of being an entree leader.
I used to work for a guy who said, you can outwork 80% of the people, and if you tell the truth all the time, you can beat about another 15% of the people. The last 5% is a dogfight. And, you know, it really is kind of that simple, but that kind of is what I thought of when I remember you saying every successful business has a monopoly.
That's right, because if you are the one and only, if you are the best rib shop within, you know, 18 blocks of this location, at least best in my mind.
My mouth just watered.
Then I will put up with the fact that you're not the cheapest, or that you're not the most convenient, or that whatever. If you are the one and only, you're the one that's easy for me to make a referral about. Right? So if I'm walking down the street in New York and I bump into someone and they and I sort of know them and they say, I'm going out for ramen noodles, where should I go? I can happily look at them and say, well, go to Kokoron, because they're only 4 blocks away. They're the one and only. You will not come back and ask for your money back because I sent you there. This place has a monopoly. But if you come up to me and say, where should I get a cup of coffee? And there's 18 places within a block away. I'll say, figure it out. There's no upside for me in making this referral, because there is no one and only.
And the way you become the one and only is not only quality and service, it's atmosphere and being able to tell the story. I was with the guy that owns a big winery in Napa a couple of weeks ago, and he was chairman of Premier Napa last year, where they do the rollouts for all the wines. And he was telling me some very interesting data that the wine people are, I don't know why they're just discovering it, because for me it was kind of like obvious when he said it. The vast majority of people who buy a bottle of wine, if they're not buying just cheap stuff for whatever reason, but I mean, if they're buying a good, quote, good bottle of wine with dinner or from a store, they are connected to a brand or a certain bottle of wine that is connected somehow to a story. Stories sell wine. Good wine more than anything else, because there's a lot of $100 Cabernet out there, right? A lot of it. A lot of $100 to $200 bottles of Cab. And if you're going to buy one of those, there's usually a story connected. People connect with these stories. Talk about how important it is to, when you're going to become that one and only, to have that story and to relate it.
I'm so glad you're bringing up this category and this topic, because most of the people listening are not in the wine business, which makes it a perfect thing for us to analyze. I know you like wine. You know I don't drink wine, and so we're perfect colleagues to talk this through. The first couple facts for people to understand is that the cost of making a bottle of wine is under $5 for all wine everywhere. It's not, wine doesn't cost more because it costs more to make. Wine costs more because more people want to buy it. And so there are a couple interesting ways we can take this apart. When I was in Napa 3 months ago, missed you, we had to get out of there early in the morning, and there were 18 wineries nearby, and only one of them opened at 9:30. All the other ones opened at 10. So the people who are open at 9:30, of course, have a monopoly in that moment. So the story I told myself as a neophyte who was buying presents for his friends was, it's this or nothing. That's a story. Another story is, what's the provenance of this, in that who was the person that's behind it? So if there's 18 or 25 or 50 different wines to choose from, but this guy has a reputation previously, it gives the purchaser permission to believe. And one of the facts we know about wine is that if we take 50 people who are not trained sommeliers and give them five bottles of wine that cost between $30 and $200, they will not be able to tell them apart, because we're not able to tell wine apart without sufficient training. We are able to tell stories apart. And so it's not just the label or the name. It's what did the sommelier say when she served it to you? It's did it have some sort of backstory to it about where it was grown or why it was grown or what it was called or what year it was grown, that enable us in a full placebo effect, brain-activated way, to decide that we have made a good choice in this moment. And the thing that is worth saying to the skeptic who says, well, that sounds like a sham, is if $100 brings you that sort of joy and you can afford it, it's a bargain, right? That no one needs to get different molecules for the $100. What they need to get for the $100 is a story worth telling themselves, and then maybe one worth telling their friends.
It's not unusual at all for me to be with someone and they say, well, we had that, you know, we were in Chicago and had a special dinner on our anniversary night, and so this has been our favorite ever since. So it ties back into the experience.
Exactly.
And that becomes part of it. And, you know, that's not just true with something. Wine has a sense of romance to it, but that, where maybe you're plumbing or something doesn't, but there's still a story to be told around it. It could be a crisis that was solved. It could be the water heater blew up and the water was 2 inches deep in the house, and here comes Joe with a Superman cape on. Well, from then on, Joe is Superman.
Exactly. And I'll tell you one of my favorite small business marketing stories. 100 years ago, when the Yellow Pages came out, it was a partnership between AT&T and R.R. Donnelly, and the kind of business you need to sell the Yellow Page ads to is not a business that knows how to buy advertising or marketing. Pizza places don't think that way. So how do you get pizza places to buy ads in the Yellow Pages? So what they did was they would show up at the pizza place and they would say, is the owner here? We want to give you a free ad in this book. And the owner would come out and say, here's the deal. We're going to put a free ad in the Yellow, you know, they trusted AT&T. We're going to put a free ad in the Yellow Pages, but we're also going to install a second telephone line in your shop, a yellow one. And all the phone number you list in the Yellow Pages ad has to be the phone number for the yellow phone. And the guy's got nothing to lose, so he signs up. And then 3 months later, the sales guy would come back, and he'd say, I'm here to remove the yellow phone. And they'd say, what do you mean? You can't take out the yellow phone. It's the one that rings all the time. And they'd say, well, you know, your ad's up, and you need to renew, or else we got to take out the yellow phone. So they didn't go in with charts and graphs and proof that this would grow the business. They went in and they said, if you don't pay up, we're going to penalize your business. And that's the way the typical small business owner thinks is, how do I avoid pain, not how do I go for gold? And this was a perfect example. They had seen the phone ring. It was visceral. They knew, they had held the yellow phone in their hand. And now you're going to come take that away. And that shift in storytelling built a business that over time was worth $1 trillion.
Hmm. Amazing. Tell us, we've got a lot of folks listening that are micro businesses, cottage industry, starting from a card table in their living room. Tell folks how you got started.
Well, you know, I love your card table model. I got started only 5 blocks away from where Lillian Vernon literally got started on her card table. So it's real. I mean, most businesses that aren't passed down from generation to generation, that's how they start. In my case, there are two origin stories. When I was in high school, I started several businesses, a ski club that ran for a few years. I sold ice cream sandwiches in my new high school when it was under construction. These were seat-of-the-pants, $200 invested sort of businesses. I wasn't trying to make a living. I was just trying to make a ruckus. And what I learned early on is, it wasn't particularly easy to find people who would root for you because they felt like they would then be responsible if you failed. And I was super fortunate that I had two parents that did root for me, refused to put up any money, but said, go do this. We can't promise it's going to work, but it's way better than not doing it. After that experience, and I think it helped me get into college, I co-founded a business there that became the largest student business in the country, and again, got the experience of starting dozens of little businesses, not to make money because I didn't get to keep the profit. But again, I saw what it was like to fail, and there was an enormous amount of failure associated with starting those businesses. And so I thought I was ready, after I went to business school and had a real job, to go be a real entrepreneur, and I was wrong. And the reason I was wrong is this. When I started for the third time, and I had a wife and I was trying to be a genuine business person, this was early in the desktop publishing days. I didn't have enough money to buy a laser printer, so I had to walk down the street to use the laser printer at this printer shop for $1 a page. So every letter I sent out cost me cash money. And I got 900 rejection letters in a row from the book publishers in New York. 900.
Which book was that?
It was 30 books to 30 publishers.
Oh, okay.
I was 0 for 30 for 30. And what shifted for me was this was the first time I was actually doing it for keeps. But the other two times had been, this is my hobby, what's interesting? But this time it was, if I don't sell something, I either have to go get a job as a bank teller or my family goes hungry. And I didn't want either of those things to happen. And I finally sold the book for $3,000, which hardly paid for macaroni and cheese. But it wasn't until I realized that the stress and the pain was fueling my resistance, was fueling my fear, was fueling my conservatism, that I saw that taking it too seriously was actually crippling what I was trying to do. And when I finally pushed myself to let go and to disconnect the making a living from the making a difference, that's when my business finally started to work. Is that I needed to be generous and calm and patient, all of which are hard to do when you're fighting off people who are asking for money.
Yeah, when you're broke, yeah. It's usually when I get desperate, right after that I get stupid.
Exactly.
And I get stressed out, and my generosity pulls back, and those are death knells. They really are. It's bad news. So what would Seth, you know, people? I tell people I've gotten to have lunch with you and sit down and have a bagel with you, and I name drop like that. I don't name drop many people, but I name drop this one, and then they look at me with great jealousy. So if Seth Godin today could have a cup of coffee or a bagel with Seth Godin, who's 30, what would you tell him?
Okay. The first thing I would tell him, and you're not going to believe me, is to go read some Dave Ramsey books. I'm serious.
He hits it back over the net. That's good, yeah.
I'm serious. You know, here's the thing. For 8 years, I struggled on the edge of bankruptcy. For 8 years, I was alone. I had no support. I was failing. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. Because if I traded it, I wouldn't be who I am now. And so I don't want to tell him something that would skip that other than reassuring him that everything will be okay. But taking your question with the intent you actually meant it, I think that in the internet world today, it's different than it was 20 years ago. And the reason is you don't have to pay for laser printing. And since the marginal cost of being generous and the marginal cost of being in the world is zero, you need to do it. That means we all own our own media company. Here you are with this, you know, one of the most popular podcasts in the world, but you have exactly the same resources dedicated to this podcast that anyone who listens to this podcast could dedicate to theirs. And here I am with a blog that's one of the most popular in the world, and it costs me $19 a year to run it. So I am using exactly the same resources to have my blog that anyone listening to this podcast could have for their blog. And so if you could build a media platform for yourself that's more than snarky stuff on Twitter, you should, because it's generous, it's the right thing to do, and it builds trust. It not only builds trust in the people who are listening to you and hearing your story, it actually builds self-trust. Because if you can say things out loud, if you can announce out loud your intent and your plan, and you can be transparent and truthful about it, the other part of your brain will read what you wrote, and you will start to believe it, and it will make it more likely that you will be consistently generous and trustworthy going forward.
Seth published two books in the last year. He put out four, rather, in January, but two of them are We Are All Weird, and that's under the Domino Project, which I was blessed to be a tiny, tiny little part of. The Icarus Deception, which broke records for its size and the speed that it reached its goals on Kickstarter. You certainly can find all of those at Amazon. You can find them all at sethgodin.com. Tribes is a must-read for all of you as far as I'm concerned. And for that matter, the whole lineup is. Meatball Sunday is a great one as well. Seth, what is the actual website if they want to read your blog daily and register for it?
Just type Seth into the Google, and it generally finds me.
You're pretty recognizable quick. Google wakes things up pretty quickly. Well, and it's the most successful marketing blog in the world, and this is probably the greatest marketing mind walking the planet right now that we're talking to. So really, really blessed to have you today. Thank you for taking time with us. I appreciate your generosity, and folks get takeaways out of these things that do change their life. You are talking to a group of people you move the needle for, and so we appreciate you taking your time, sir.
Well, thank you. The work you do matters, and I know you don't hear it often enough, but thank you, because you don't have to do this, and I, for one, appreciate the fact that you do.
No, thank you. Seth Godin is our guest here on Entree Leadership. I'm Dave Ramsey, filling in for Chris Hogan today. I stepped on him and pushed him out of the way because Seth was going to be here, and I wanted to hang out with him online, and so what a joy to call him friend, but also to be able to have him here and share with you guys and gals listening out there some really, I mean, almost philosophical looks at how business really goes down these days. You know, we're so tactical around here, it's good for us to stop occasionally and back up and look at the ideas and the reasons, the why behind what we do. So I've also invited Daniel Tardy to join me for the second part of this, for this major announcement that we're doing, which is just pretty cool stuff. Some pretty neat things happening around here. Daniel is the Vice President of Entree Leadership. He manages all things Entree around here, leads all things Entree around here. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
Cool. So let's talk about this for a second. The history of Entree Leadership is so kind of rich, isn't it?
Mm, yeah. It's something that, when you started teaching it here internally, I've had the privilege of growing up with this brand and sitting as a participant on the front row of the classes that you taught to our team before I was ever even a leadership position. And with the first events and everything, it's been really fun to be on the the front lines of helping kind of push this brand out into the marketplace. But yeah, absolutely, absolutely rich history.
We started and took the first big event took place, what we now call Entree Leadership Master Series. We just called it Entree Leadership in those days. Small group of people. Started back in 2005, and we did it at a hotel here in Nashville, and have done several that way over the years, and then took it on the road to resort locations. But we've consistently had about 20 times the interest in the Entree Leadership experience than what the event will hold. We've never allowed them to be over 200 people. They are sold out almost every single time. I can't think of just a handful of times it didn't sell out over the years. And we do two of those a year. And even with two Master Series events and two of the Performance Series, which Chris Hogan does, and eight of our one-day events, which Chris and I and John Acuff, some others will do, plus the podcast, plus the New York Times number one best-selling book, you know, we still got tens of thousands of business leaders asking us for more ways to access this content, more ways to plug into this Entree Leadership tribe. And we've been working really hard to pull together an online solution that was scalable, that would just empower business leaders to have direct access to these Entree Leadership principles. And, well, it's finally here. Here's the big announcement. Daniel, this was kind of your brainchild. You've sat on this until you hatched it anyway, for sure. And so talk about this vision and the redesign and where we're going with it.
Yeah, well, it's apropos that we're talking to Seth today about tribes, because I think Seth really was a lot of the inspiration for us realizing that we have a tribe with Entree Leadership, but we're missing one of the key components that Seth talks about in his book, which is a medium by which the tribe can stay connected to each other and to the tribe leader, you, and the Entree Leadership brand. And with the events and the book and the podcast, a lot of our dialogue with our audience has been limited to, I guess I would say, those synchronous mediums versus an asynchronous. We had to be all in the same place in a conference room at the same time, and that was magical every time we did it. But then we'd all go back home, and there's kind of this fragmented disconnect. And we've sensed for a long time, I've dreamed about this day when we could have a online platform where Entree leaders can connect with each other, connect to this material, and stay connected to our team in a way that helps them not only with being inspired, but the application of these Entree Leadership principles day in and day out.
And we're calling that Direct Access.
Entree Leadership Direct Access.
And it'll be at EntreeLeadership.com.
Go to EntreeLeadership.com, and we've loaded this thing full of video tips. We've got e-coaching sessions on there. We've got Entree Leadership Master Series lessons on video for the first time ever that we'll be rolling clips out via a blog. I mean, similar to what Seth's doing. It doesn't take much more than that for people to have a place to come in and consume content, contribute to the conversation, and the contribution part of that from our tribe is one thing we're really excited about, of getting these guys in, Iowa, who've got a plumbing business, to talk to maybe a dentist in Kansas City about an Entree Leadership principle and encourage each other and ask questions. And because our business leaders that follow us are smart, they have good ideas, they're great at sales, they're great at marketing, they're out there on the front lines and the backbone of the economy on Main Street in America every single day. And so we believe in the power of the small business owner, and we believe in the power of the small business tribe connecting with each other around these Entree Leadership principles. So there's a chance not only for them to hear more content and consume more content from us, but to really get a dialogue going with their peers in the marketplace.
Yeah, really, the reason we're doing this is what Seth was talking about, being market-driven versus marketing-driven, in that the one thing we have all heard, me, you, everyone involved in the Entree Leadership process, from a one-day experience to a EPS to an Entree Master Series. After it's over, there, I want to stay connected. I want to, because you form bonds during that week we're together. When we do the 1 week events, but if not, we still form bonds psychographically. We have this shared interest of understanding how to win in business, how to do it the right way, a way that you're proud of, a way that is servant oriented rather than where you're just extracting resources from the marketplace. Instead, you're there to help, and there's all this commonality, and people wanted desperately to stay connected, and honestly, it's taken us too long to put this together. It should have happened a while back, but it's finally here.
It's
so
here.
We're finally doing it, and you are have been the catalyst to get it out there. So congratulations on your leadership on that. A great job, and it's called Direct Access. You can tap into it at EntreeLeadership.com. EntreeLeadership.com is going is being revamped. Is going to have a feel to it now that it didn't have, and is going to become all things Entree, where you used to kind of go to DaveRamsey.com and slip over into the corner and click way down over to the left or something and find Entree Leadership. But now we're just going to take you straight into Entree Leadership and just let those of you that are interacting with this part of what we do just have direct access. Now, this thing is chocked full of valuable things to help folks. So I'm sure there's an investment involved. What have you got laid out there?
Sure. So there's plenty of stuff that we want to be generous and give away for free. For example, our podcast listeners are regularly now going to hear about encore interviews and podcast extras and show notes and things like that that we're going to host on EntreeLeadership.com via the direct access tier that's a free membership. And there's plenty of things in terms of content that we're going to put out there. The discussions, the access to conversations with your fellow tribe members, if you're an Entree leader, will be completely free. And then there's options to upgrade, either purchase a la carte these individual Master Series video lessons that have previously been exclusive to a very high-end event. We're really excited to make these lessons available now in a way where you don't have to show up and take a full week of your time and make a big capital outlay if you're not able to.
If you want to watch me teach on delegation, you can just click on it and
for a fee,
watch that one video.
Watch the video and the lessons, the notes that we use to accompany the Master Series event. Each of those will be available as a PDF. You can download that, walk your team through it. So just an incredible value and something that we've been dreaming about. And not just dreaming in a vacuum. Our tribe has been begging for this. We've been, you know, for years, people say, I want to come to the event, but I can't make it. My daughter's getting married that week or whatever it may be. And so now we've got a solution where people can get that content and do it in kind of a la carte format. And then there's a membership level if they want to upgrade and get really premium access to weekly e-coaching sessions, get plugged into an online mastermind group, have all of the Master Series lessons available included in their membership. That's called All Access, and they can learn more about that if they go to EntreeLeadership.com and choose to upgrade to that level.
So direct access is just the hub of the wheel that you, where you can look at everything and feel and touch all these different things, including all the free content. But if you want, like if you're going to a concert, all access backstage, that's the membership level, and you can find out about that at Entree Leadership as well.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're actually going to give away one of our a la carte Master Series video lessons. That's $199 value. Anybody that creates a free direct access account by the end of September, we're going to just give them one of our premium a la carte lessons completely free. So go create a free account, get a free $200 value, and join the conversation.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, this is a conversation. This is not just you driving by and picking up something. There's give and take in a conversation. Both people speak. Both people are engaged. That's how it works. Well, Daniel, great job on this. I've, of course, gone over the wireframes on this as they were building it out and looked at what they were doing and been involved, and our leadership team here is all around working with Daniel on this, and it's very, very well done. Direct access at EntreeLeadership.com. It's a whole new way of approaching this material. You're certainly always going to have this podcast. We're certainly going to continue to do the things we've always done. This is just more. This is just mayonnaise on the bread, baby. It's that simple. So it doesn't get any better than that.
Sounds like a good sandwich.
Yeah. I just now wanted a really red, ripe Tennessee tomato and a piece of bologna to go with that somehow. But anyway, that's how it works. Well, thank you, Daniel. Great job.
Thanks to
Seth Godin. Obviously, wonderful content on this particular podcast. Just a joy to get to spend time with him. Anytime you've got questions that you'd like included or addressed on the podcast, you just email us your questions at podcast@EntreeLeadership.com. You can follow us on Twitter @EntreeLeadership. And remember, keep learning and keep leading. Until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, and grow your profits.